It is a privilege, really, for all of us to think together about the remarkable life of Dr. Albert Schweitzer and about the implications of his life for us today. And maybe I could say just a little bit further by way of background about myself, that growing up on the southwest side of Chicago, it really was a mantra that we all understood in the Kelly family, and I think it extended throughout the nation. Don't be acting too big for your britches, Kathy. That was my mother. Now, you don't want to be caught acting too big for your britches. And I'm not sure I ever quite figured out what it meant to be acting too big for your britches, but Dr. Albert Schweitzer, or the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, two heroes of mine in my life, I think would have counseled differently and would have told us it's okay to act too big for your britches. And the other thing that was sort of a mantra around the Kelly family household was that if mom or dad raised their voices, we were all sure the world was coming to an end. We just weren't couched to express anger. So I'd like to begin tonight by remembering with you a story that some of you may have heard before, in which on at least three points during the story, Dr. Albert Schweitzer blew his stack. He was very angry. And I think this story has been quite helpful to me. You know, Dr. Schweitzer meant it when he said, reverence for all of life. It seems to have been one of the shining, most brilliant moments in his life when he finally had encapsulated this philosophy that said reverence for all of life. So he's at the hospital that he'd founded in Lambaréné. They just finished breakfast, and the orderlies know that there's a commotion going on outside in which they feel like they should prevent a man from coming to see Dr. Schweitzer because the man is old and he's sweaty and he's grimy and they haven't figured out what his problem is. But Dr. Schweitzer happens upon the scene and he asks, what does this man want? And the man is about 70 years old. He's got tears streaking down his face and he says that he was told in his village, which is quite some distance away, he'd come by boat and he'd walked up a steep hill, he was told that the only person who could save his friend was this white man, Dr. Schweitzer. And Dr. Schweitzer asked him, well, where is your friend? And he looked down on a mat, and there was his friend whose nose was poking out from under a blanket. His friend was a dog. And Dr. Schweitzer was immediately very tender with the dog. He knelt down and he asked what had happened, and the friend explained that some hunters hadn't meant to do it, but they'd fired into the dog's abdomen one of their bullets, and really it seemed as though the dog was in the last throes of his life, according to Dr. Edgar Berman, who tells this story. He was at Dr. Schweitzer's side, and Dr. Schweitzer said to the old man, your friend is very, very sick and may not make it, but we'll try to help. And the old man was at the feet of Dr. Schweitzer with his gratitude. And meanwhile, Dr. Schweitzer was asking the doctor in charge of the surgery theater, how soon can we go to work on this dog? And the doctor said, well, about 2 hours from now. And Dr. Schweitzer gave him an ice-cold glare and asked him who was going to take precedence over the dog. And the young doctor said, well, I'm scheduled to do a surgery for a woman who is in need of this surgery. And he said, how long has she been in need of the surgery? And he said, for about 2 months. And Schweitzer got very, very angry and said, well, then she can wait 2 more hours. We're going to operate on the dog. And the dog was so sick that it died on the operating table. And Dr. Schweitzer took the man aside and he said, I very much admire how you have felt for your friend. And he counseled the man, try to find a new friend as soon as you can so that you won't be lonely for this friend. And he talked with the man for a good 20 minutes, and it almost seemed as though he wanted to take the man in his arms, according to Dr. Berman. And then he said goodbye to the man. They provisioned him with food and water, and he got on his boat, and the man went away. And Dr. Schweitzer had promised the man, we'll give your dog a proper burial. So he went in to instruct the orderlies about where they could bury the dog. And he looked and he asked the doctor, the young surgeon, where is the man's friend? And the young surgeon and the orderlies looked over to the waste receptacle and they dumped the carcass inside the garbage. And Dr. Schweitzer was infuriated. And he boomed out, how dare you? Don't you understand anything? I'll send the whole lot of you back to Europe. And so this was Dr. Schweitzer, so intent on this idea of reverence for life, a reverence for life that flings the door open, a man well beyond his time, that flings the door open. Now, we in our society, we're pretty partial toward our dogs. We privilege our dogs. We don't kill them. We don't eat them. We think it would be horrible if anybody did. But think about our relationship to other species. And think about what it means to have reverence for all of life, to really respect the fact that, okay, not everybody can live, not every being can live, not every being can be sustained on our planet, that we could have respect for the fact that every being pulsates and that our lives are not necessarily to be viewed as that much better than the lives of other beings. We could have respect. And I suppose if you're at all like me, you might start to think, well, Dr. Schweitzer, within our own species, we humans aren't doing all that well at respecting and showing reverence for life amongst our own human species. And I think that in that case, it's also important to remember that Dr. Schweitzer, who felt that tenderness for the dog, might feel some tenderness for us too. And we could certainly acknowledge that we're doing our best, and we are trying, many of us all the time. And yet, if we look in the mirror, there is, I think, a need for all of us to acknowledge that we have failed rather badly to put an end to the wars that afflict other people, and some of those wars are not even known. And so Dr. Schweitzer, when he was a young fellow in 1906, he gave a talk, a sermon really, and he said that we should always be practicing as our mission atonement for those stories that appear in the newspapers that talk about the abuses that humans heap upon other abuses, and those stories that are never told that happen under the quiet of night in the jungles. And he was somebody who had great, great concern for those people who, because of colonialism, had been treated as though they were non-people. So I would like to ask you to kind of move with me through a few other stories that might be instructive about the kind of quest that Dr. Schweitzer had set for himself. You know, he entitled one of his books, The Quest for the Historical Jesus. And I don't really think that he could find the Jesus whom he loved so much, who exemplified perfection in theology alone. He had to go outside the confines of academia and take himself off to a place where he knew he could be engaged in healing in order to try to find this Jesus, because he could try to emulate what he respected about Jesus. So I'd like to tell you about a doctor whom I first met in Gaza. And this was back in 2009 and 10. Dr. Atala Tarazi had been trying in an emergency room in Gaza to treat patients who had been flooding into the emergency room at the Al-Shifa Hospital because the Operation Cast Lead had begun, and it was a 22-day assault. It was an aerial assault, and the Israelis had waged it against people on the Gaza Strip because Hamas had fired rockets into villages on the other side of the border with Gaza and Israel. And as was mentioned, the disproportionate capacity to kill was very much in evidence all throughout Operation Cast Lead, because the Israelis were using very sophisticated weaponry, attacking a civilian population, and this included many children. Well, I went into Gaza during the final days of that operation, and I do remember that a bomb exploded once every 11 minutes. We timed it once every 11 minutes. Either an Apache helicopter would fire a Hellfire missile, or a 500-pound bomb would explode. And I'm no ballistics expert. The reason I started to recognize what to call those deafening explosions and sickening thuds was because the children taught it to me. Well, Dr. Atala Al-Tarazi had, after the bombing was ended, taken a few of us on a tour, if you will, through the hospital, which had been a nightmarish scene for him throughout that time. And he talked about how at the emergency room people were lying on the floor in pools of blood and they were doing their best to save people. But I realized that where he would go after a full day's work, and maybe he was feeling as angry as Dr. Schweitzer was in his own way, and just as Dr. Schweitzer would go off and be alone by himself and need to take some time out, this doctor would go to be at the bedside of a woman whose family couldn't be with her. And so he took us to that bedside as well. And we got to know a woman named Saba Abu Halimi. And she had lived in a small village called Al-Atatra. And when we listened to her story, quite honestly, I was maybe hoping that she was overcome by some of the drugs they were giving her, and maybe the story wasn't entirely as she believed it to be. Maybe it wasn't as awful as it sounded to be. But after we went to visit her village, and after I met her son and pieced the story together, and then later learned more about it because Sabrina Tavernis, writing for the New York Times, filled out the story, I realized that most of it, as she understood it, was correct. Her house was just a little bit higher than some of the other houses in the village. And for that reason, when the Israelis were invading her village, they wanted to take over her house. And the white phosphorus missiles that are often fired in order to cloud the movement of soldiers were for some reason fired directly inside her home. Three tank-fired white phosphorus missiles exploded. And even though she and her husband and her children thought they'd be safe hiding in a small room with no windows, in fact, that was maybe one of the worst places to be, as the white phosphorus flames engulfed the home. And they burned her baby daughter, her three boys, and her husband to death. And she herself was very badly burned. And the white phosphorus is a kind of an ingredient which, once it's exposed to oxygen, keeps on burning. And so the doctors at the Al-Shifa hospital were so puzzled, they didn't know what to do. You know, they think they were removing tissue and taking care of the burn, and then they'd find that when the chemical was exposed to oxygen, the burning would continue. So it's a horrific kind of a weapon. I met her son, and he had been collecting the remnants of his father's body, and he felt that it was so important to tell me, "I will give my father a proper burial." And we said, "Oh yes, we're sure you will." And then he said, "Come and see inside this home." And you see, this was his first time being able to go back into his family home, because you couldn't be out and about while the aerial bombardment was happening. So we'd gone in with him, and I was stunned because the home was totally ransacked. But you see, this is what soldiers have to do, whether it's the U.S. following a night raid in a village in Afghanistan or Israeli soldiers going into the village of Al-Atatra. They're afraid maybe they might be facing a booby trap, and so they empty out all of the cabinets and all of the drawers, and they rip open all of the mattresses. And so you find clothes and mattress stuffing all over the floors, and furniture broken and windows broken. And in this home, written on the wall in green spray paint, in Arabic that perhaps was earnestly meant, I don't know, but written on the wall was Min Jesh Israelim, Nachnun Sifa, from the Israeli defense, "We're sorry." It's almost been like another mantra to me, because I want to emphasize the pronoun was "we." Maybe this was one individual, but the pronoun was "we." And as I say, I don't know. Was it meant as a sort of monstrous, cynical comment? Or was it perhaps meant, "We're sorry"? But I want to hold on to it. I want to hold on to those two words, because I think they unlock the door that we need if we're to feel reverence for all of life. "We're sorry." Two words we very seldom hear from the people who are at the levers of power in London, in Washington, D.C., in elites, salons all around the world. "We're sorry, we're so very sorry." And so let me shift the gears to the mirror that's closer to us. January 19th, General Petraeus in Afghanistan was gloating because he'd heard a military report that pleased him. And he said, "We've got our teeth in their jugular, and we're not going to let go now." And I want to hear those words from the wall. Let the handwriting on the wall be seen. "We're sorry." No, actually, we're sorry. We're really sorry. We don't want to have our teeth in the jugular of these people in Afghanistan. February 19th, 1 month later, the president of Afghanistan had called General Petraeus and his top aide to come to the presidential palace. And Karzai was beside himself. 66 people had been killed in a United States aerial attack, and people were coming to Karzai's office and demanding an investigation, and they did the investigation, and it seemed, yes, these were civilians. And General Petraeus held the line. He said, no, only 7 of them were civilians. The rest were insurgents. And President Karzai's aides came forward with pictures, and they said, well, what shall we say? These are children. These are pictures of children who survived, but you can see they are burned badly. And General Petraeus said, well, actually, that's what Afghan parents sometimes do in order to discipline their children. They boil them. They burn them. And so I want to again say those words that I saw in green spray paint on the wall. We're sorry. Actually, we're very, very sorry. We don't mean that. We believe you love your children just as much as we love ours. And so then March 1st, some of you would remember the My Lai massacre. I first want to tell you about Afghan youth peace volunteer children whom I've grown to love very, very much in 4 trips over to Afghanistan in the past year. And these are some of the most hardworking kids you could ever want to meet. And they're decent and wonderful youngsters. But Zekrullah, for instance, gets up at 2 o'clock in the morning about once every 2 weeks, and he puts 2 baskets on either side of his donkey, and he rides 6 hours out to a mountainside where the mountainside isn't denuded of trees yet, and he can pick up scrub brush and twigs and firewood. And then he rides the donkey back another 6 hours to his home, and he helps load the scrub brush and the twigs and the firewood on the roof of the home, because they don't get electricity in Afghanistan, even though the United States has been spending $2 billion per week. You have so many families without any electricity whatsoever, and they need to rely on this firewood for their fuel. And then after he's done with that, he goes out to go and get water to bring back to the family, and then he might work out in the fields to pull potatoes out of the ground or plant the potatoes, and then he tries as hard as he can to study, but you see, he's never really quite learned how to read and write properly, so he put himself back into second grade, knowing that that's really where he maxed out in terms of his literacy skills. Zekrullah is a very hard worker, a very engaging youngster. So he's on my mind when I hear that on March 1st, 9 youngsters, probably very similar to Zekrullah in their socioeconomic background, had been sent by their parents out to the mountainside to get the fuel. And for some reason, the helicopter that hovered above came down more close to the children, and the children must have been very, very frightened with this big, huge combat helicopter flying over their heads and then coming down low. And there was one boy who said he saw a green flash, and then the helicopter went up very high, and the helicopter gunship operators began systematically to shoot each one of the 9 boys. But when they began shooting, one of the trees cracked in half, and that's what saved the life of young Wahid, who told this story as an eyewitness. General Petraeus apologized the next day. He said, "We're sorry. This tragedy should never have happened." And I don't know whether he apologized the next day because there was an eyewitness or because there had been such a hue and cry over the earlier statements that he had made, but the apology is there. I don't know if the United States people join in that apology, because you see, these stories are so frequent, so regular, that they only merit 2 to 3 lines in the morning newspaper. And so it goes that we have a very difficult time seeing ourselves as we're seen by other people really all around the world, and certainly in Afghanistan. There's a Pakistani journalist who wrote once that hunger and anger combined are like 2 live wires. You combine them together and it creates an incandescent flash that maybe isn't controllable. And I speak to you as one who was kind of afraid of the whole notion of anger, but now I want to hear the anger that was expressed to us in Afghanistan. Let me tell you first about a young man, an engineering student, who had been part of the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, and he's rejected it. He said he doesn't understand how anybody could ever believe that he and his friends could ever feel nonviolence toward the United States. And I was a bit taken aback. And then he held up to me a picture of a cover of a Time magazine issue. And some of you would know this issue. It was the picture of the face of a little girl named Aisha, and her nose had been mutilated by the men in her own family as a punishment because they believed she had violated the sexual mores of their community. And it's a hideous story. And Aisha is still in some process of recovery now. But this young student, holding up that picture of Time magazine, which had a subtitle that said, "Why We Must Stay," fixed his eyes on me and asked me, "Miss Kathy, do Americans care more about noses than fingers?" And I honestly didn't know what he was talking about. And I looked at him and I asked him to repeat it. And he said, "Do Americans care more about noses than fingers?" And I looked at my companions and no one else seemed to have an answer. And I just quickly jotted something down in my notes. And I came back in October to New York, and I was at the Mary House Catholic Worker and jet-lagged and first to grab the New York Times, opened it up, and then I realized, oh, now I see what he meant. Because that was the day the New York Times was reporting on a military tribunal that was investigating whether or not to court-martial soldiers from the United States who were part of a striker brigade, S-T-R-Y-K-E-R, and these are urban combat brigades that are trained to be in some of the most horrible riot situations. They're trained to endure extremely violent situations. And it must have been that while they were in Iraq, they had sustained a great deal of post-traumatic stress disorder, because in Afghanistan, this striker brigade was accused of having formed a killing spree, killing teams that found their satisfaction in identifying civilians that they could execute in cold blood and avoid any kind of censure for it. The squadron commander was bragging, saying, "I've figured out ways to kill Afghans and you'll never get in trouble for it. We won't have to worry about the rules of international warfare. We can bypass that." And then it really wasn't all that difficult, I suppose. You just steal a weapon from another Afghan, and you place that weapon on the body of the person whom you killed, and then you spread the word around that this person was attacking you, and you can get away with this. Well, they got away with it repeatedly, and maybe it began to develop its own cycle, so that the next thing that came along was the idea that they could also cut off the body parts of the civilians that they'd killed and store those as war trophies to be brought home later. And so eventually, they were convicted of this. But at the time that the story was written, I myself was just learning of it. And at the time that the young student from Bamyan asked me about it, I'm part of the peace movement, and I didn't even know what he was talking about. So I have to hear his question. That white-hot anger that informed and fused his question, "Do Americans care more about noses than fingers?" When I went to Afghanistan in the last three trips, I went to a place called Charahi Khambar. And this is a place where there are at least 1,000 families who are among the 10,000 families, minimum, that have poured into Kabul, the capital city, because they've been displaced by the war. And when I first walked into the Charahi Khambar camp, the children went running to go and get the village elders. And I was a bit taken aback because the village elders were about half my age. But you see, the average lifespan in Afghanistan is 42 years of age. And so yes, the elders had dark black beards and flowing black hair. And they were quite angry. One of them flicked a blanket that was placed over a tarp that covered one of the mud huts that they had built for themselves. And immediately there was a puff of dust and smoke and the blanket ripped. It was so decrepit it would be a useless protection against the harsh elements that were coming in the winter time. And I looked and saw that most of the people were barefoot and their clothing was wretched and their children looked very hungry. And the man said to me, "Do you think that we like to live this way?" And I didn't really have an answer. And then another man, still looking down at the ground, pulled out of his pocket two crumpled photos. And the photos showed his children their mutilated bodies covered with blood. And as it turned out, a United States drone attack had directly attacked the home of this man and his three brothers, and that's why they had left the Sangin district of the Helmand province, and they'd come to Kabul, along with so many other families that were displaced, because they couldn't afford to wait and see if they might be attacked again. And when I've gone back to visit these three brothers in subsequent visits, I went back during the very cold time, and yes, they were very cold, and so was I, and they took me further into the camp, and they took me inside one of the smaller huts, and I sat inside, and I kind of huddled next to one of the younger girls, mostly to kind of warm up. And then her uncle came over, and he gently unzipped the top of her jacket and pulled it aside so that I could see that Jumagul's arm had been cut off from her body, torn off by that same drone attack. And you know, as the people in the Chari Kambar camp, this wretched refugee camp, the most squalid I've ever encountered, where they're burning garbage in order to have fuel, as they look across the road, they see truck after truck after truck going into a new United States military base under construction, bringing water, bringing fuel, bringing ammunition, bringing food. And of course, you don't want the soldiers from the United States to be lacking those things, but I think we have to ask ourselves about the 7,000 trucks per month that cross into Afghanistan and the $1,500 that apparently it costs in order to pay just for one of those trucks to go along a small stretch of land through the protection racket that the United States has helped to build up. A $2.16 billion contract has been signed with various trucking agencies that are actually run by, some of them, the Taliban. And so how do we ever get to the extraordinary amount of $2 billion per week being spent on this war while 850 Afghan children die every single day? Do their lives cost reverence for life? We're sorry. From the people of the United States, we're so very sorry. And yet, for the people of the United States, many people, quite honestly, aren't even aware that this warfare goes on. And so I think about the two live wires, hunger and anger, and how when they're touched together, there could be an incandescent flash. But let me tell another story, perhaps more along the line of tenderness that Dr. Schweitzer was also so much an advocate of. I've been part of a group called Voices in the Wilderness. Gabe and Teresa and I were very much part of keeping this going, and I want to especially single them out and welcome them back to the United States. They've, since that time, when we would go back and forth to Iraq to violate the economic sanctions, started a brilliant program called the Iraq Student Project and have brought numerous Iraqi students over to the United States to study. Well, we learned a lot in those travels back and forth to Iraq about hospitality. But I've always known that anybody who would follow me anywhere is in big trouble, because I'll get us lost unquestionably. I have absolutely no sense of direction, and sometimes no common sense either. And so it happened that one night in Pakistan, when we had stayed maybe a little bit too late at a university student gathering, Josh Brolier and I were in the back of a rickshaw going along an unpaved road on a steamy hot night. The dust and the sweat and the grime and these unpaved roads were completely unmanageable. The driver of the rickshaw was so frustrated because my cell phone was out of juice and we couldn't quite figure out where we were or how to get to where we were. I only knew we're going to the Garrison School for Boys, and I knew there were three different campuses. So finally, after a half hour of roaming around, the rickshaw driver finds a sign that says Garrison School for Boys, and he was so happy to get rid of us. He was knocking on the door, had his charges inside the courtyard, and I knew we were in the wrong place. The people in whose courtyard we had just entered graciously looked at us. They don't know us from Adam's house cat, but they were sleeping in their courtyard because it was so very hot, and the father of this household gently picked up two children, laid them on the same cot that he shared with his spouse, disappeared, and came back out with a power strip, a long cord, and a fan so that the guests, whom he doesn't know from Adam's house cat, would be able to have a breeze of sorts. And his wife then came out with tea for us, and then they just looked at us as though, well, you're with us for the night. And this is the kind of hospitality that is communal, historical, and practiced in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in cultures where it simply wouldn't be questioned. It would be an obligation. Another courtyard story. On May 1st, the United States night raid squad had been given a bad tip. And so before they even went into the courtyard, they lobbed a grenade in that immediately killed Niloufer, a 12-year-old girl, as she lay on her cot. It hit her right in the head. And then they burst in, and the man who had actually been a policeman working with the Afghan army, being trained by the United States, who was told to stay home that night because he didn't really know his way around the village where they were going to be, had run out with his gun, and they immediately killed him. And this kind of story goes on again and again and again. What we could learn from the hospitality of other people. And so I think about Dr. Schweitzer, you know, after that day that he blew his stack, he was so angry, he went off to be by himself, and he just stayed oftentimes, they said, at night with his animals, his pelican and a dog or a cat that would come up to be with him. And I think maybe we too have to slow down, go off by ourselves, let ourselves feel anger over where our situation has gone with our country having become a country waging war after war after war, our menacing might creating anything but security in this country, the ways in which these wars have created terrible impoverishment because we can't meet the human needs, the human rights of people in our own country, because the military keeps taking more and more and more and spending it on eliminating the possibility of life and childhood in other countries. Maybe we need to slow down and feel angry and then be ready to be just a little bit too big for our britches, but to do so communally, to do so in league with one another. And I think this is part of that questing that Dr. Schweitzer was all about. He really did see in his philosophy that he'd happened upon after so much thought that reverence for life, for all of life, should be something that everyone should be able to come together on and want to practice and desire. And so that's part of the vision that we would hold up. So you can imagine it wasn't very easy for my Irish mother when the first time I was acting too big for my britches and had to go and get arrested in Chicago's federal building, I was arrested for singing an Irish ballad. It was an Irish ballad that was written by Padraic Colum, and he's someone who had, when the Irish conscripts were taken by the British Army off to the Seychelles Islands, felt very great anguish as he saw them returning, because they were returning sometimes without an eye and without an arm and without a limb. And I've thought about that song and Padraic Colum and the anguish he felt, especially because I was more recently at this emergency hospital, the Emergency Surgical Center for Victims of War in Afghanistan, run by people who I think are, in a sense, the inheritors of Dr. Schweitzer's vision. They're people who say, we don't ask questions. We'll stitch anybody up who comes to our hospitals. And I actually, when I stayed there, I was asking more questions than I think the doctors were, because they just believe that all of the people are their brothers and sisters. And so I have O negative blood, so they're always happy to see me so I can donate this blood that's kind of valuable. And after I donated the blood, was actually a little bit woozy. So I sat down, and for some reason, a young boy thought I was a German doctor. I don't know where he got this idea. And he hobbled over, and his face was bandaged. And you see, just previously, I was away, but I think you may have heard about it, there was a man in Florida who believed that he should burn the Quran. And when he did that, this occasioned uproars in various communities, Muslim communities all around the world. And this young boy's father, who was a very devout cleric, and another cleric and teacher, said to this young man and his friends, you should go to this demonstration, and on behalf of Allah and for your faith, you should be in the front of the demonstration and show that you're angry that the Quran was burned. So they were in the town of Mazar-e-Sharif in Afghanistan, And this young boy and his friends, because they wanted to please the father and the teachers, were up in the front, and then suddenly the demonstration took off in a different direction, and instead of going to the United States military base, they were at the UN, and they must have perhaps surprised the people at the UN compound. I have no idea who shot first, but this young boy, his face bandaged but showing part of one eye, kept repeating to me, "I have lost my eye forever," as though he needed to somehow convince himself of this reality. "I have lost my eye forever." And so I think of him as I think of the words to the ballad that we sang when we wanted to prevent young people from joining, enlisting in the military in this country. This was back in 1979. "They're rolling out the guns again, hurroo, hurroo. They're rolling out the guns again, hurroo, hurroo. They're rolling out the guns again, but they'll never take our daughters and sons again. No, they'll never take our daughters and sons again. Oh, Johnny, I'm swearing to you. Where are your eyes that looked so mild, hurroo, hurroo? Where are your eyes that looked so mild, hurroo, hurroo? Where are your eyes that looked so mild before you ran from me and the child? When my heart you first beguiled, oh, why did you run from me and the child? Oh, Johnny, I hardly knew you. Where are your legs that used to run, hurroo, hurroo? Where are your legs that used to run, hurroo, hurroo? Where are your legs that used to run before you went to carry a gun? I believe your dancing days are done. Oh, Johnny, I'm swearing to you." And the singer goes on to ask, "Where are your arms? You're an eyeless, armless, chickenless egg," she says. "You'll have to be put out with a bull to beg, but your Peggy will never leave you." And then I hear that anger at the end. Maybe you could sing it with me. "They're rolling out the guns again, hurroo, hurroo. They're rolling out the guns again, hurroo, hurroo. They're rolling out the guns again, but they'll never take our daughters and sons again. No, they'll never take our daughters and sons again. Oh, Johnny, I'm swearing to ya. Haditullah, I'm swearing to ya. Saifullah, I'm swearing to ya. Ismatullah, I'm swearing to you." We can swear. We can swear by the light of what Dr. Albert Schweitzer has stood for, by the light of what so many other kindred spirits have stood for, that we will pledge ourselves to put an end to war, that we will pledge ourselves to say every day, "We're sorry. We're so very sorry for what war has done to our country, to the lives of children in our futures, to people in other countries, to the lives of their children," to say we're sorry, and then to amend our lives, to say that we don't want to take more than is our fair share, that we don't want to be aligned with the fat cats that profit from the wars, to say that we would prefer to live simply, to share our resources equitably, and to be of service, to have the privilege to be of service to other people, and thereby to quest for Jesus, for that persistent personality type that you always find of people who try to emulate the values of Jesus, but most essentially for communities that will so hunger for an end to war that our hunger and anger combined might be like an incandescent flash and might create a change that's uncontrollable. I'd certainly welcome your observations, questions, ideas, thoughts. Some of you may be Schweitzer experts here in this room, and especially those of you who are Schweitzer fellows and have actually tried to follow what he taught through your own different pursuits, care delivery, maybe theology study. Mm-hmm. This is Salma speaking, who works with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Thank you for your honesty, Salma. You know, there's a story in the Christian New Testament scriptures about Thomas saying that he would not be able to believe until he could stick his hand in the wound of Jesus. And I think that for myself, had I not had the actual connection of being with people, I probably would not be motivated. So I can certainly understand what you're saying, that we can easily feel quite distanced. And I think that Albert Schweitzer came up with an answer for his own life. He just left academia. He left the securities of being a well-regarded musician and author in Europe. And he said, I've got to clear out of here and try to actually align my life with the man whom I believed was so perfect, with Jesus. And so, you know, sometimes he's actually criticized for being a bit patronizing toward the people that he was trying to serve. But I think he did take an action that, to me, suggests what all of us can do. We can look for the personalities, the people whom we think are trying to accomplish what we like to be open to rather than shut to, and then go be with them. You know, for some in a previous generation, it was Dorothy Day and David Dellinger. And I can certainly suggest people in this time that people could link up with. I think about Father Jerry Zawada out on the borders of Tucson, picking up people who have fallen dehydrated and possibly might die if they weren't assisted. I think of Gabe and Therese, whom I had mentioned earlier with the Iraq Student Project. There's so many people that are doing activities that we could align ourselves with. And to me, that's the way to not shut down. One piece of advice I have for all of us is something I also heard on the southwest side of Chicago. If you spread the peanut butter too thin, the bread ripped. And I think it's important to find some issue that you care deeply about and really give yourself over to that issue. Research it, be an expert on it, know your facts and figures, and through that often you can in fact open up all kinds of other doors and windows of analysis and understanding as well. But I think probably in this room we've got many people who are scholars who have studied a particular issue or problem for a long time. Some of you speak multiple languages, and so we know the discipline that's required to really understand a great deal about a particular issue. And so I think that's one thing. I found myself turning the page and not paying attention, even though I would have just come back from Afghanistan, not paying attention because the media attentiveness, as you so well described, was so very, very brief. So at Voices for Creative Nonviolence, what we decided to do, and it's a grim task that we set ourselves, but we call it the Afghan Atrocities Update. And we're kind of forcing ourselves, if you will, every day to monitor the news, and when unarmed civilians are killed by the United States, NATO, ISAF troops, we write it up and we keep this running. And it's in part to discipline ourselves to pay attention. And this is why I think also, Helen, you were suggesting this, I really mean it, to slow down. Because by the time you've gotten yourself into the national religion of shopping, you're going to be caught up with mandatory gift giving and running back and forth to the shopping malls and keeping up with the weddings and the baptisms and the graduations and the birthdays. And you know, you can really become very pressured and maybe not even all that happy. And that's not even beginning to talk about the play dates and the soccer games and the organizing that has to go into keeping our kids entertained and involved in sports. And this is great for the powers that be that would like to conduct wars without us standing up to them. without us feeling angry, because we're so busy trying to make sure that we get the kids to all the different sports and entertainment events, and that we ourselves go to all of the mandatory gift-giving events and toss in some holidays and, you know, people paying attention to the floods. And who is going to have time to notice that the United States is slaughtering civilians in Afghanistan who meant us no harm? So it works so well for the war profiteers. And I'm going to say a word that Muriel Lester used. It's actually not something that's usually part of my vocabulary, but I did say it earlier, the fat cats, the people who are making money hand over fist and running with their portfolios stuffed to the banks, because these weapons can create tremendous wealth for those who manufacture, store, sell, and use them. And you have to use them, because otherwise how can you make more? And so the major corporations, and we know all this, you know, with the military-industrial complex, but I think that the slowing down part is not, even though I'm very taken by Albert Schweitzer being so angry and then going off by himself to cool down, according to this story by Edgar Berman, but we can't just stay in our own personal shutdown or slowed down space. We have to then link up, find kindred spirits, and form the kinds of communities that would hunger for change. And we've seen it happen in the history of the United States before. I mean, if we go back through the Freedom Rider history, what country on earth in history has had a finer witness, and this is a very recent witness as things go, a finer witness of determined, we will not give up, risk-taking, life-threatening activism? We've got so many examples in the very baby, small, short history of the United States. So I think even though our present leadership may eschew these examples, may mock these examples, we have them. We have the examples of ending the Vietnam War, of getting the right for women to vote, of union organizing, of the civil rights movement. And people all around the world prize those examples as saying, this is who Americans are. But we have to look in the mirror and say, yeah, that's who we are. We're not the people who would celebrate as citizens our capacity to murder other people. If that's not who we are, then we ought not to be that. But it takes work, because that's where our society tries to push us. Well, Anya, I just want to show you the picture that's up on the screen right now. David Smith Perry is a wonderful poet. His book is over on the table. And that's Abdullahi. And this is one of the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers. And this is the whole group of them in one of the most beautiful spots in the world. The families are tremendously impoverished, but these kids certainly live in a beautiful spot in the world. And that's Zekerullah, whom I mentioned, in front of a peace park that the youngsters tried to create. And they cleared out rubbles and stone and planted trees and set up this Bamiyan Peace Park. And Zekerullah is the one I mentioned who should have been in seventh grade but put himself back into second grade because he realized that he didn't know how to read and write. And I especially want to, from what Anya was saying, call your attention to this photo. I hope you can see. I'm sitting on the floor with a group of young women and their mom, who is the furthest to the right there. And I had just asked them, did you ever hear of a day when a passenger airplane flew into a big, tall building in my country? And these young women were looking at the translator and looking at me, and you could tell they were wondering, what is she talking about? They had never heard of 9/11. It has certainly affected their young lives, but they honestly had never heard of it before. And yet the United States has been at war with their country for this unbearable long time, with now $2 billion per week being spent on that war, and as I mentioned, 850 children dying every day. These youngsters are part of the Hazara community. They're the most discriminated against within Afghanistan. And then this little boy is actually smiling, but you can tell that his father isn't. And this is from the Chadihi Khanbar refugee camp, where the father was so frightened for how he would be able to help his children survive. How could he protect his children? And then this is the man who had the pictures of his children in his pocket, the one that's got the rosary beads, I'm sorry, the worry beads behind his back. And they had just explained to us why they had fled from the Sangin district of the Helmand province and come to live in this wretched refugee camp. And then the person who owned the camp said that he didn't want his land to be sullied by latrines being built on his land. Well, imagine 1,000 families living in close quarters and no latrines. And he said there couldn't be any new wells dug. So this little girl is trying to bring water back to her family from the well that does exist. So I just wanted to give you those pictures of some of the people that we've gotten to know with amongst the Afghan youth peace volunteers. We have a delegation there in Afghanistan now. And they say that at night they go to bed tearful because it seems as though there are so very few options, openings for people to be able to move toward a better life. Well, I certainly see Amy Goodman as a national heroine. She does the Democracy Now, and it is possible to get that here in Chicago, and you can also watch it on your computer if you don't mind looking at a computer screen. I read the New York Times every day, and I find that, you know, if you read an article to the very last paragraph, you'll know more about the issue than you did when you started. But if you start to know a lot about an issue, then you can certainly see the biases of the New York Times. I think quite often it's a good idea to try to listen to people who've come from an area like Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria, but know that you are never going to hear one monolithic story that encompasses everybody's varied histories. I also want to say how impressed I am that Gabe and Teresa learned Arabic through and through, are extremely fluent. And that makes a big difference. So if somebody can speak the language, then I would kind of want to hear quite a lot from that person. Well, I think one question we can all be asking is, why is the United States at war in Afghanistan at all? And this is a set of maps which I had actually first seen in the New York Times maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I think. But when I was in Pakistan, almost every person that I mentioned these maps to who was English-speaking and affluent or educated had seen these maps. And the map on the left-hand side is the real deal. Those are the borders. Notice that long border between Pakistan and Iran. Afghanistan sort of sandwiched in between Iran and Pakistan. And notice Pakistan's border with China. Now, the United States is, I think, arguably in a cold war with China. We don't like to say so because we're economically interdependent with China. But the United States does not want to be in a position where the Chinese government has cheaper access to indispensable fossil fuels and natural gas and other kinds of energy resources. We don't want to be in a situation where they can get theirs more cheaply than we get ours. And so geopolitically, when people who are in think tanks have been asked, well, what could be done? One major thing is to consider, well, Pakistan is the only country in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, which has the nuclear bomb. And Pakistan might have a shared border with China that wouldn't be so advantageous to the United States. So what if the border between Pakistan and Iran were cut off because you see that Free Balochistan, and there is a Baluchi revolution being waged in Balochistan that we hear very little about. So what if they ever broke away from Pakistan? Well, that would take a substantial part of Pakistan off the map. And what if the Afghan country sort of arced over and cut off the border with China? Well, then Pakistan would be a sliver of its former self. And added to that map would be something that a guy named Pepe Escobar kind of irreverently calls Pipelinistan. Because you see, way up there in Turkmenistan, at the top of that map, that's where there now is a UNICAL project which is being sort of revisited. It was started in the 90s, and that was a project to bring very valuable natural gas and other fossil fuels from the Caspian Sea Basin up at the top of that map, to bring that across Afghanistan and then across Pakistan and perhaps into India. So it's called the Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India pipeline. And then there's another pipeline that the Iranians would like to build that is called the peace pipeline that goes across Iran, across Pakistan, and into India. So at the NATO meeting that happened in Lisbon in 2009 in November, the NATO countries were exultant because the Asia Development Bank had signed on the line and said, we'll bankroll this TAPI pipeline. And it hasn't been built yet. They're going to start the construction soon, and it will be finished in 2014, according to plan. And when can the United States troops leave Afghanistan? 2014. And why are the troops in Afghanistan? Is it possible that the United States wants 200 forward operating bases all across Afghanistan so that the United States can be able to guarantee the production, the construction of this pipeline, which would be advantageous in terms of United States relations with China? If all that's true, then my young friend in Bamyan, the university student, has every right to say, do Americans care more about noses than fingers, and berate us, because the real reason we're over there has nothing to do with young Aisha and her protection. And it has even less to do with the 850 mothers who carry the bundles of their dead children every day to the cemetery. It has much more to do with United States people being able to get cheap access to the fossil fuels that we hog, that we overconsume, and that we could wreck our planet with, because we don't care enough to say to Mother Earth, we're sorry, we're so very sorry. So slow down. Okay, I don't even know how to drive a car. Nobody ever wanted to teach me. But I don't know anybody who's got a worse carbon imprint than me. I fly all over the place. It can't be excused. The 2 years that I tried to do Greyhound and Amtrak, I swear I took 5 years off my life. But I'm here to tell you, Greyhound despises its customers. But I know that this is what we have to try to do. We, each of us, individually and collectively, have to try to figure out how can we learn to live our lives differently. Find the nearest Catholic worker house. You'll find these houses of hospitality in every seedy, rundown neighborhood across this country. And these are the people who are offering hospitality. They're out trying to promote peace and justice. They'll risk their lives in war zones. They go to jail often and sometimes for a long time. And I think their carbon footprint is so enviable, because they're not trying to take more. They're trying to figure out how to give more. And that's just one example. Thank you. The question is, to what extent should you try to maybe win people over to an idea rather than be so blunt with the paradigm shifts that you're suggesting that might even threaten another person that you might lose the possibility to engage someone? To me, I think one of the biggest failings in my own effort is that I have not figured out how to get beyond the choir. I was actually hoping that maybe tonight there'd be some people who are outside the choir. If you're there, I'm very glad you're here. But I think that we very much need to try always to figure out how can we reach the people who might be conversant with wanting change, who might be hungering for change, who might be angry and hungering for change. And then to be able to help people feel balanced, draw people in, especially I'm thinking about students, and give a sense of ground that people can stand on. There's a person that some of us in this room would know. His name was Father Larry Rosebaugh. He was executed in Guatemala by robbers 2 summers ago. And I so admired the way he put it. He said, we should all of us have 1 foot firmly planted among those who are bearing the brunt of United States wars, whether it's a war in another country or the war at home against the poor, and the other foot firmly planted amongst people who are trying to nonviolently resist those wars, and therein we can find our equilibrium. And I think when we've got that 1 foot firmly planted among people who are bearing the brunt, then it becomes obvious that your authenticity is at least a little bit sustained, because you're at least trying to, as Dr. Schweitzer did, be among those who are going to be punished the most by the practices that sometimes in this country we can benefit from by sheer accident of birth. Well, again, I have to say I was very, very fortunate. I kind of married into it. I married Carl Meyer, and he was a protege of Dorothy Day with the Catholic Worker Movement. And as much as I grew up in a family where we were told not to be acting too big for our britches. Carl grew up in a family where his dad was in Congress and his mother expected that her two boys were going to be movers and shakers. And so he had developed some relationship with some of the freedom riders who, when they would be going across the United States, would sometimes stop at our kitchen. And so I had a chance to hear the likes of Wally and Juanita Nelson and Ernest Bromley and Maurice McCracken, and I was just dumbfounded by their stories. But I have to tell you, I recently went back and reread that history because I needed to put a little more wind in my sails. And so I again want to stress the value of knowing our forebears and what kinds of risk-taking have happened in the stories that have eventually moved toward people gaining more justice in our world. And I'm thinking particularly of the freedom riders right now. But one of the things I would say is that when we do take risks, and this is again the word privilege coming to mind, even when I've risked losing a job, which I've done so a couple of times. I'm a war tax refuser. I won't pay for war. I haven't paid my taxes since 1980. I would never hire me if I was any kind of a person in authority to make that decision. But I have not gone to prison because of not paying war taxes, and I've managed to successfully avoid the payment of war taxes. But the risks are so minuscule compared to people in other countries, including the young people I just showed you right now. I'm not going to have a death squad at my door. I'm not going to have my house burned down, as happened with some of these young boys. I'm not going to have to worry about whether or not one of my relatives might be pulled in and questioned and interrogated and tortured. I'm not going to have to worry about a massacre of my village. These are the kinds of risks that other people, the other people that Dr. Schweitzer wanted to campaign for because he said the colonialists had made their lives so miserable. These are the risks that other people have had to face, but we won't have to face those if we exercise our privilege and do speak up. We have tremendous freedom of speech. Congress shall make no law to abridge the right of people to assemble peaceably for redress of grievance. We don't do it. We don't take advantage of it. When was the last time we were inside Senator Durbin's office or Senator Kirk's office campaigning and saying, we won't leave until you explain to us who benefits from this war and what security are we gaining from this war? We could be doing that. And our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world, in Afghanistan particularly, need us to do that. But I think that it's become perhaps a sense of overestimated risk that prevents us from undertaking actions that, if we think logically and rationally about the next generations and the children we love, make all the sense in the world. What kind of a world are we passing off to these children? I mean, think about the proliferation of the nuclear bomb, something Dr. Schweitzer campaigned against. In 1945, one country had the nuclear bomb. And now look at us. Do we think that these drones aren't going to proliferate? Can you imagine? Right now, countries, 49 different countries are developing these drones. 250 companies are in advanced levels of drone development. Robotized warfare is upon us. These robotized weapon systems could actually end up being appealed to by the generals and the warmongers because they won't be able to handle the influx of so much information, and they'll have to toss it up to the mechanized level in order to do decision-making about using weapons. What kind of a world are we handing off to the children while we're asleep at the wheel or saying, well, we like the scenery, so the train might go over the cliff, but we like the scenery? It doesn't make sense. We know it doesn't make sense. But we continue to live our lives as though we don't have options. That's ridiculous. We have so many options, and that's why the Reverence for Life theme is actually so exciting to me, because there was Albert Schweitzer saying reverence for all of life, animal life, plant life, and he was so far ahead of his time, and we're sort of, I think, now beginning to catch on, even though we do privilege our dogs over the other species. Think of it. If we really, as communities, said, we're going to practice reverence for all of life. Thank you. And also, within the academic structures, where better to open these doors and turn on the lights than amongst the young people's minds? But often, I think they get turned into indentured servants who, when they get out of our institutions, are going to have to run so fast to try to pay back the loans that they've racked up. So I challenge everybody within academia. Remember, Chicago in 1968 was a city where a lot of people were tackling the issues about the war. Well, we've got NATO and the G8 assembling in Chicago in May of 2012. Will we raise some questions? I want to throw a retirement party for NATO. But I think we should be asking our young people to examine these questions and give them confidence, give them support to stand up and to speak up and to speak out as these NATO and G8 characters assemble, and not let Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the Chicago Police Department intimidate people in Chicago into thinking if you do get involved, you might find yourself hauled in front of a grand jury. Me and all my friends together, the risks are very minimal. Well, I think that Dr. Schweitzer would be exactly with you in exactly what you've enunciated. I don't know if people were able to hear. Well, I'll try to communicate what you said so eloquently, but Paul is talking about how his garden is a place wherein the rabbits proliferate, and if he tries to make the garden effective, then he's going to have to kill some of the animal life, like the little earthworms when he starts to dig in his garden. He's only accidentally killed the earthworms. But I think that it's a biological reality that every form of life can't possibly be sustained simultaneously. We have to accept that. But that doesn't mean that we can't recognize respectfully the desire to live, the enjoyment of life, the reality of shared life on this planet. Now, even that, just that mindset, is a big shift, because I think that we've certainly been schooled in our Western understanding to think that we're kind of it, and we're at the apex, and that other forms of life aren't to be at all regarded as essential for the ongoing life of the planet, if it's in any way going to interfere with our human understanding. And I think this is the exciting thing that Dr. Schweitzer opened up in his understanding of reverence for life. Of course, we can't sustain all of life, but can we be respectful? Can we be remorseful when we do find ourselves taking from the life force of other species and of other beings? And here we are as human beings, and we find ourselves not even knowing when we're directly responsible for the killing of other human beings. Well, let me again thank Ray for inviting us, and to the Schweitzer Fellows, and to Loyola University for hosting us here, and Dr. Fogarty, thank you very much also. And I would encourage you, there's some free literature over there on the table. I'm supposed to try and sell some of the other items that are there, so if you'd like to buy a book, David Smith Ferry's poetry is superb, and I wrote a foreword to that. Or a t-shirt, and Gabe's and Teresa's book from the Iraqi Student Project, a book of poetry, will certainly put wind in your sails as you hear from young Iraqi people what their hopes and dreams are.